Tammy Woodward was one of those women who could hold her own in any room. She was sharp, funny, a little no-nonsense, but the kind of person who'd still hand you her last cigarette if it looked like you needed it. She worked hard, she loved fiercely, and she didn't tolerate much nonsense. She was 46 when she vanished, living in Alton, Illinois, and by all accounts, she had finally started to find a kind of peace in her life that had been missing for a while. Bonnie had a job that she loved at Eunice Smith Nursing Home, where she worked as a nurse's aide. It wasn't particularly glamorous work, but she was very good at it, and the kind of good that came from compassion, like a natural sense of compassion, and not just her training. Her co-workers said she was always the first to step up when a patient needed comfort. One of them told a reporter, Bonnie didn't just take care of people, she mothered them. She had this big laugh that carried down the hallways, and she'd show up to every shift with her coffee, her hair pulled back, usually running a few minutes late normally, because, you know, life. And people always seemed to pull her in six different directions at once. Bonnie spent almost her entire adult life working at Eunice Smith Nursing Home. So 25 years plus. That was actually closer to 27, depending on which employment record you want to look at. And I don't know if you've ever worked in a care home or had a loved one in one, but it is not a job that someone usually sticks with, especially not for nearly three decades, unless it's who they are at their core. People don't stay in those kind of jobs because they're easy. They stay because they are steady, nurturing people who understand that real care is in the small, repetitive little things. Brushing someone's hair, adjusting their pillow, and remembering how they like their tea. Or knowing which resident is comforted by music and which one just needs their hand held quietly, no talking. So you can tell a lot by someone by their work. And what we know about Bonnie from how she lived is that she was consistent. She showed up. She did what was needed. She wasn't dramatic about it. She wasn't chaotic. And she certainly wasn't the center of any kind of storm. She was the person who held things together. And she did that in her personal life as well. She was the mother of four children, and by 2010, she also had grandchildren. Her home life wasn't perfect. I mean, whose is? There were dynamics and stress and relationships that were kind of being fluid, but just like in any family, she was there. She was the steady. And there's something really deeply loving about that kind of steadiness in a family. It's not the flashy, social media friendly kind of love. It's that real kind of love. Bonnie was also in a long-term relationship with a man named Gary Wilmerth, Gary Sr. as he was known in his family. And they lived together in a quiet, lived-in kind of way. The kind of relationship where you don't really need to constantly talk about where you stand with each other because it's just kind of understood. They shared their bills, their routines. It was just kind of domestic peace. And Gary would later tell investigators that Bonnie didn't just disappear. Like, she would not do that because she had people that she cared about. And that's the thing, right? The people who disappear suddenly are almost always never the steady types, like the ones who go to work all the time and pay their bills and take all their medications on time and make sure that there's milk in the fridge and call their kids and remember everybody's birthdays. People like that don't just evaporate into thin air, which brings us then to the fracture that was happening in her life. One of Bonnie's four children was her teenage daughter, Heather. And now, if you've ever had a teenager in your life, I probably don't need to explain a single thing further, but Heather's situation had complexity layered into it. She had been living with another family, the Carrolls. She had actually run away from Bonnie's home. Now, running away is one of those phrases that kind of probably hides about six novels worth of emotional content. It can mean there was anger, conflict, fear, rebellion, confusion, identity, control, sometimes all at the same time. But here's what really matters. Bonnie was trying to get her daughter to come back home, not as like a power move, and it wasn't punishment, but it was because it was something that's just something parents do when they're still trying, even when the relationship is a bit strained, and even when their kid is starting to pull away or is angry at them or has shut down. You keep that door open. You keep their bed made, and you keep showing up even when you're being pushed away. But Heather wasn't just staying with a friend's family. Like, she was staying in the home of a man named Roger Carroll. He was a man that was significantly older than her, who, according to later testimony, had a kind of an influence over her that went a little beyond what would ever be appropriate for like a 16 or 17 year old to be under. The Carroll home was where Heather felt connected for some reason. She felt seen there and supported, which is not unusual. I think teens often go where they feel emotionally understood. But Roger wasn't just letting Heather stay. He was, as we later learn, shaping that relationship. And so this is where that coercive control that I keep talking about, though we're not going to call it that right away, because Bonnie didn't have those words then. Most people probably don't. Most people only realize that they're dealing with coercion in hindsight, when the damage has kind of already happened. But what Bonnie was trying to do was get her daughter back. And what Roger saw was a threat, because Bonnie represented something that Roger did not want in his life, which was things like structure, boundaries, accountability, and the reality that Heather was still a child and was not his to mold. And that conflict that follows is not loud or dramatic. It's the kind of conflict that you later recognize, which kind of hinges everything on. Bonnie believed her daughter belonged back home, and Roger thought he knew better. And so both of these forces, the maternal love and kind of controlling possession, were kind of moving towards each other in a train wreck that's about to happen. Now, the difference is one of them was grounded in care and the other was rooted in more ownership and entitlement. So Bonnie's coworkers later remembered her as being distracted in the weeks leading up to her disappearance. Not panicked and not frightened. She was just tired and worried. I mean, that kind of quiet worry that a mother would carry with them when they're just trying to bring their child back home without pushing them away further. So this was not at the time a woman who felt she was in danger. This was a woman that was just trying to fix something in a careful, gentle way, because the stakes for her were very high. But she had no idea that the danger that this situation was with her daughter was going to put her in, that it was with a man that did not want to let her daughter go. So it is June 25th, 2010. It's a Friday. Bonnie goes to work at the nursing home, same as she has done every day for decades. And her coworkers clock her in as normal. She's busy. She's focused. She's doing what nurse's aides do. She's just constantly buzzing around, rarely sitting down and watching everyone else but herself. And then she finished her shift. There was really nothing special to that. There was no raised voices that day. No strange calls came in. No one that she confided in later about some ominous final thing like, oh, if anything ever happens to me. Like, this is not Dateline here. Normal people do not narrate their own foreshadowing. So Bonnie clocks out, gathers her things, and then heads out to the parking lot where her red Chevy Avalanche is parked. Now, this is where the story starts to tilt a little bit. Multiple witnesses later tell the police that they saw Bonnie talking to a man next to her truck. It was a white male, middle-aged, average build, this is the least helpful description of anyone in the Midwest. It's like saying, like, he looked like a guy. We're going to need something a little bit more specific, but one detail does stand out. It was a gray or silver Chevy Malibu that was parked nearby. And that's important because Roger Carroll, remember him, that older man who should not have been entangled in a teenager's life, drove a silver Chevy Malibu, which is interesting. Now we're close enough to the scent trail that the dog starts doing that excited little butt wiggle that they do. But here's where it gets more suspicious. Bonnie does not come home. Not that night, not the next morning, not ever. And so this is where Gary, her live-in boyfriend, makes all of us want to stand up and applaud, because he reports her as missing right away. He doesn't wait and think like, oh, maybe she needed a little bit of space, or she probably went for a drive, or she's probably out with a friend. No, he knew her and he knows her patterns, and he knows that Bonnie does not just leave. And so this is something that always matters in missing persons cases. The people who know the missing person best are usually right. And so Bonnie being gone was wrong, and the kind of wrong that has its own like temperature, the kind that makes your chest feel like you just swallowed a stone or something. So police located Bonnie's truck, which was parked near the Illinois River. Its windows were rolled down, and immediately every single one of Bonnie's children and all coworkers say the exact same thing. Bonnie would never leave her windows down, which honestly really tells you kind of everything. Like, if you know that you just wouldn't do that. We all have that one window setting that we live by. And so some of us are windows down until it's snowing, and some of us are air conditioning only, or like nothing, like we keep our windows rolled up. I'm a rolled up person. And Bonnie was also a windows up person, the truck was always locked, keys accounted for kind of person. So right off the bat, the vehicle scenes just screams that this doesn't look right badly. Like, it's a first day on crime drama internship badly. But then they did the fingerprinting and the results came back, and well, guess whose fingerprints are on the driver's side door handle? Roger freaking Carroll. The same man who had taken Bonnie's 17-year-old daughter into his home, and the same man who was 40-something and acting like he and Heather were like soul-connected bestest buddies in that way that made absolutely no lawful sense to anybody, and the same man who had been at odds with Bonnie because a parent wanting their teenager back will always kind of threaten an adult who thinks they have the emotional authority over that teenager. So detectives do their detecting. And so they go and talk to Roger. And Roger, I swear to God, says the most probably suspicious sentence that any human can possibly say in a homicide investigation. He says, "Well, then I guess I'm being framed."
"You've denied repeatedly any kind of association with Bonnie or her car or your car or whatever. Any chance your fingerprints would be on Bonnie's car, on the driver's door, like all over it?"
"No, no way, no."
"No chance?"
"No."
"Okay. Any chance your DNA be all over that driver's door?"
"No. Turtle bank."
"And how do we explain it if it is?"
"They're not framed. I mean, no, there's no way that my fingerprints are on that car door or my DNA is on that car door. There's just no way."
For the record, your obstructing justice charge is based on that very thing, that your prints are on that door. Driver's door."
"Sir, no. The only people who say, 'I guess I'm being framed,' are murderers and people who watch way too much late night crime TV. Not me." But Roger jumped straight to season finale conspiracy theory brain, which is the equivalent of screaming like, "I'm guilty," and really bad at it. So then you ask, why wasn't he arrested right then and there? Well, because now this part matters, there was no body and there's no eyewitness to any kind of violence. So this was one of the hardest realities in missing persons homicides, is that you can know who did it. You can feel it, smell it, see the outline of it on the ground, but legally you can't do a damn thing without any proof. And so the case kind of stalls for 8 years. 8 years of no body, no arrest, no closure, holidays with an empty chair, calls that don't come in, you can't make a call out to them, leads that dry up, and detectives that are just kind of rotating in and out of the file. 8 years where Bonnie's family had to live in that awful in-between place where you're grieving someone that you cannot bury, and somewhere in that time, you know what Roger Carroll was doing. He's living his life. He's having barbecues. He's going to Walmart. He's complaining about the weather, like all of the rest of the people in the Midwest, because people who commit violence this cold don't usually tend to unravel afterwards. They just kind of continue on. And that's the part that never stops being horrifying. So 8 years go by. 8 years of the world just turning on like nothing happened. 8 years of birthdays and Christmas stockings and family dinners with that empty seat at the table. 8 years of Bonnie being missing, but of course not forgotten. And 8 years of Roger Carroll just walking around, mowing his lawn, drinking his coffee, telling his stupid stories, and the whole time knowing exactly where Bonnie was. Until August of 2018, and that's when the cracks finally start to show. And like many good cracks in deeply buried secrets, this starts with, wait for it, a domestic violence disturbance call. Because men like Roger never just do one terrible thing. No, they like to do these bundle deals. So if he can control one person, then he'll need to control whoever else he's nearest to as well. So the police responded to the Carroll home. Someone is crying and someone else is yelling there. And Roger, in true I am the tragic center victim universe thing, tries to make this moment into like his grand misunderstood martyr monologue, and turns to his wife Monica and says, "I have killed for you." Which is, if you're trying not to look guilty, I would likely gently remind anyone that that sentence is probably one that you don't want to say. Like, he might as well have walked into a police station wearing a t-shirt that said, "Ask me about the homicide I recently committed." Now, Monica does not immediately run out and call the detectives because, well, control does not really end very cleanly. There's a little bit of shock and some denial and some fear and calculation. But a sentence like that doesn't just kind of leave. It kind of sits somewhere behind your eyes and just kind of hums there. And eventually she tells law enforcement that that was the moment that the little hinge that swings the heavy door kind of opened. And so the detectives reopened the case and go to Roger's son, Nathan. And this is where everything kind of breaks open. Now, by this point, Nathan is not a teenager anymore. He's an adult, which means time has kind of done its thing. The space between the act of killing and his conscience has kind of widened just enough for guilt to kind of crawl in there. And so he sits down with the investigators at his mother's kind of wishing, and he tells them the thing that shifts this from a suspicious disappearance to, oh my God, how did nobody see this coming? So Nathan says that his father lured Bonnie by telling her that Heather, her daughter, wanted to talk to her. So Roger drove to the nursing home and met her in the parking lot when she got off of work. And she went in, got into his car willingly, because a mother will always go if she believes her kid's calling for her. And then he says that Roger shot her. Not in like kind of a frenzy, some kind of burst of passion. No, he did it very calmly with authority like a man that was carrying out a decision that he had already made. And then, because this is where entitlement kind of goes from bad to mythic, Roger takes Bonnie back to his property and builds this bonfire. Not a campfire, not a little backyard s'mores situation, a fire big enough to burn for 3 whole days, produce smoke that the neighbors noticed and required shifts to actually maintain that fire, and then leave charred bone fragments embedded into the soil and the tree line. And then he had Nathan help dispose of what was left, these little bits of ashes. There are crimes of heat and crimes of cold, and a crime of heat is impulsive, it's panicked, it's sloppy. But this was cold. This was organized, it was sustained, it was controlled, and it was collaborative. And that, ironically, is exactly what convicted him. Because the minute a second person is kind of involved, there is your future witness there. Secrets shared are secrets that are kind of scheduled to collapse at some point. So once Nathan had led detectives to the fire pit and this tree line where the fragments were found, and the waterway where they had disposed of the ash and some of these fragments, and the exact firearm that was used, the case was no longer a whodunit. It was about how long it was going to actually take for a jury to say guilty. So a U.S. Department of Agriculture botanist analyzed the tree growth rings near the burn site and found that there was damage consistent with extreme heat. And in 2010, in that growing season, so the trees actually kind of testified there. And honestly, I think that's beautiful. So your secrets are not smarter, I guess, than chlorophyll. Meanwhile, Roger is still convinced that he is the smartest man in the room. So when he was interrogated and presented with his fingerprints that were on Bonnie's truck years earlier, Roger repeats his Olympic tier bad liar classic, "Someone must have planted them then." Like, detectives do not go around sprinkling fingerprints like Parmesan. Like, just sit down, sir. Trials are rarely like TV. They are long, they're slow, they're procedural, but the emotional gravity in a courtroom where someone has been missing for 8 years is really something that you can feel even just in the transcript. And this trial took place in March of 2020, so just before the world shut down for some other reasons. But inside that courthouse, the only thing that really mattered was finally saying Bonnie's name in a room where someone had to answer for it. Now, the key witness, the one that everything kind of hinged on, was Nathan Carroll, Roger's son. And so this is the part of the story where the room just kind of went quiet, because when a son testifies against his father in a murder trial, it is never simple. There is no version of events where that moment is not traumatic. But there is also no version of events where this case reaches justice without him being involved. So Nathan takes the stand and he walks up to the thing and he sits and he faces the jury. Now, he does not look at his father at all. The prosecutor's questions are pretty steady, simple. They're kind of treating him a little bit gentle, saying things like, "Nathan, can you tell the court how you first became aware of Bonnie Woodward?" And Nathan explains the basics, that Bonnie was Heather's mother, that Heather had been staying with the Carrolls, like with them, and that Bonnie wanted Heather to come home, and then that had started some conflict between Bonnie and Roger, and then that had been growing. But then we get, of course, to the day of the murder, and Nathan's voice was able to stay even. He wasn't theatrical about it, and he didn't want anyone to feel sorry for him. It was just the facts that he had kind of carried for himself for 8 years. He said, quote, "My dad told me Bonnie was coming over. He said she had to go away. Now, I didn't understand what he meant until I heard the gun." So there's really no way to soften that sentence. It, like, that lands exactly where it should. He described Roger leaving to go meet Bonnie at her workplace, bringing her back in the car. There was a moment outside near the shed where that confrontation led to the sound of a single gunshot and then Bonnie falling to the ground. So the jury kind of heard that the way we are kind of hearing it, with just kind of that horrid feeling, because this was not a rage killing. This was not a heated panic escalation. It is premeditation with like follow through. So Nathan then went on to explain that his dad had told him to help him with the fire. So he described for the jury the burn pit that they made, the wood they were using, the accelerant, the smoke, how long it had run for, which was not hours, but days. And the prosecution asks him, like, why did he help? And he said, quote, because he's my dad. And right there in that awful way is the jury understood that the story had always been a kind of about control. It was control over Heather, over the narrative, over the consequences, and then over Nathan as well, and of course over Bonnie. So control was really the currency that Roger tended to trade in. Now, let's talk a little bit about that tree. A USDA botanist took the stand and he explained that trees record trauma in their growth rings, and that the trees that were next to the fire pit on their property showed a high heat stress event in the summer of 2010, which means that the natural world did what humans sometimes cannot do. It remembered. And then, of course, there's the firearm that was found in 2010. It was identified in 2018 and was tied to Roger. And then, of course, the fingerprints on Bonnie's truck, the ones that Roger insisted had been planted, which is one of the worst lies I've ever heard attempted. There were the bone fragments, the search history on Roger's laptop, which searched the word Bonnie hundreds of times after she had disappeared. So the defense tried their classic moves, attacked the credibility of Nathan, suggest the fire was just for clearing some brush, suggest that Monica maybe misinterpreted her husband's statements that he'd made, or that the fingerprint transfer was just accidental, which all lands kind of just deflating. They're like a balloon in the room, because the jury has already kind of heard what they needed to hear, that Bonnie had said, or that Roger had said that Bonnie had to go away, and Nathan saying that he made her go away. And of course, the science speaking, saying, here's where this all happened. So on March 16th, 2020, the jury returned with a guilty of first degree murder, not manslaughter, not we can't be sure, not a compromise, but a guilty. And in October of 2020, Roger Carroll was sentenced to 65 years. So he got 40 years for the murder and then another 25 years for the use of a firearm. And those were to be served consecutively, meaning he is not leaving prison alive, probably. There was no dramatic outburst from him. There was nothing. He just kind of just took it, I guess. He just kind of stood there and let it unfold. So Bonnie didn't get to go home, and Heather didn't get to go home to her either. Her granddaughter's going to grow up hearing stories instead of having any actual memories. And that's really probably one of the actual costs. I mean, the rest of it is kind of paperwork. Roger is still serving his 65 years. He will likely die in prison. So that part is kind of handled. But the damage of kind of shaping other people's lives around this hole that was left is what doesn't quite close. Because what happened to Bonnie didn't start with violence, it started with that control. Not some big dramatic thing, just that little slow drip of, I know better than you, and I'm going to decide where you belong. And feeling that he deserved access to her child. So life has to bend around somebody else's wants. So it can look really normal from the outside that people kind of would just walk right past it. And Bonnie, of course, she didn't see it as a threat. She just saw a situation that she was really just trying to untangle. a daughter that she was trying to reach out to and restore her own home. And the man who had killed her, he didn't snap. He didn't lose control. He acted because he felt like he was going to lose control. So there's kind of a difference there. And I don't think we talk about that enough. And that's it. I mean, that is the whole lesson here. It's not a moral to the story. It's not anything really other than just this unsettling reality that there are people who just, who they don't explode when they're angry and they just decide and then they just kind of follow through. And that is terrifying. And I think Bonnie deserved to live her life. She deserved to have her daughter back in her life, and she'd earned that. She'd lived her life that way, and it probably would have happened. I think Heather would have come back to her if she'd have been allowed to just carry on with her life and hadn't been taken away by some idiot who just thought that he could control everything. I'm getting a little tired of talking about coercive control and control, but the thing about it is that it is connected to probably more homicides than it's not. And so it is something that's going to continue to come up, because I think that there's a lot of warning signs around there about impending violence that we really need to be watching for in other people and in our relationships with other people, to just always be mindful that coercive control kills. Anyways, with that, I am going to be back next week with another terrible, awful case. Probably involves coercive control. And in the meantime, you can just do your thing. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more? Check out my podcast. Hi, I'm Kadra, the host of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. I tell tales every single week that have left me perplexed. You'll hear true crime cases, mysterious disappearances, learn about cults, hear baffling sightings of cryptids, chilling paranormal encounters, and even dark and weird history. I release new episodes every Wednesday, and you can listen anywhere podcasts are available. I'm also on Patreon, and you can even watch me on YouTube. Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. Stories that will leave you perplexed.